From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Rachel told us that going to Gaza was one of the most important things she had done in her life. With other activists, she spent nights sleeping at wells in Rafah to protect them from demolition. She stood between Palestinian municipal water workers who were trying to repair wells in the Israeli military towers, from which shots rang down, harassing the workers and the internationals.
Today is the second anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie, the American peace activist crushed by an Israeli military bulldozer when she attempted to block the demolition of a Palestinian home in Gaza. Now her family is suing the State of Israel and Caterpillar, the U.S. firm that manufactured the bulldozer. We'll speak with Rachel's father and sister and their attorney in the suit against Caterpillar. And we'll talk to Washington Congressmember Adam Smith. He delivered a letter from the Corrie family to the Israeli Prime Minister calling for an independent investigation into Rachel's death. But first, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is under fire for ethics violations. We host a debate.
Well, what we have here is a pattern of abuse, of violations of the ethics rules, and then someone in a position of tremendous power, leadership in the Congress, who's actually able to dismantle the entire ethics process, leaving us with no oversight of ethics of any members of Congress.
I believe he's being prosecuted here because he's been a strong conservative and because he's such an effective leader. Many people think that Tom DeLay is the most effective majority leader in the House in 50 years.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Army and Navy has revealed that 26 prisoners have been killed while in the custody of U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. In all the cases, military investigators have concluded or suspect the deaths were acts of criminal homicide. This according to the New York Times. The number of prisoners killed is far higher than any figure previously released by the military. Another 11 prisoners were killed in what the U.S. has classified as justifiable homicides. More prisoners have died of natural causes while in detention. James Ross of Human Rights Watch said, quote, "This number to me is quite astounding. This just reflects an overall failure to take seriously the abuses that have occurred." Last week, the Pentagon sent Congress a report on prisoner abuse. It mentioned just 6 prisoner deaths. That same report concluded the widespread reports of abuse were not the result of official Pentagon policy. Deaths occurred in a number of U.S.-run prisons. Only one took place in the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Meanwhile, a U.S. Army platoon leader was sentenced Tuesday to 45 days in military prison. Lieutenant Jack Saville pleaded guilty that he ordered his troops to throw 2 Iraqi prisoners into the Tigris River. One of the prisoners has never been found and is believed to have drowned. Saville is one of the first officers to be tried for abusing prisoners in Iraq. His sentence was kept to just 45 days because he'd agreed to testify in another military trial. In that trial, Saville revealed his captain had once given him a hit list of 5 Iraqis who were to be executed on the spot if they were captured in a raid. In Iraq today, the country's new interim parliament convened for the first time inside the Green Zone. Minutes before the session opened, at least a half dozen explosions detonated nearby. The U.S. military said 2 mortar rounds landed inside the zone but caused no injuries. Inside the convention hall, windows shook and lights flickered as the explosions shook the building. Parliament's first session ended without the formation of a new government. The leading Shiite coalition and their Kurdish allies have so far failed to reach an agreement on how to share power. Meanwhile, the U.S.-led coalition of the willing continues to shrink. Italy's announced it'll begin withdrawing its troops from Iraq in September. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi made the surprise announcement on Tuesday, saying, quote, "public opinion expects it." Anti-war sentiment has increased in Italy following the death of senior intelligence officer Niccolo Calipari, who was shot dead by U.S. troops in Baghdad. He was killed shortly after he rescued Italian journalist Giuliana Sgrena, who had been held hostage. Meanwhile, Ukrainian and Dutch troops are already in the process of pulling out of Iraq. The first group of Ukrainian soldiers arrived home on Tuesday. Among the nations that withdrew last year from the so-called Coalition of the Willing were Spain, the Philippines, New Zealand, Thailand, Honduras, the Dominican Republic, Singapore, Nicaragua, Hungary, Norway, and Tonga. After Italy and Ukraine pull out its troops, only three nations besides the U.S. will have more than 1,000 soldiers in Iraq: Britain, South Korea, and Poland. A jury in New York has convicted the former CEO of WorldCom of taking part in the largest accounting fraud in corporate history. The telecommunications executive, Bernie Ebbers, faces up to 85 years in jail. The federal jury found Ebbers guilty of securities fraud, conspiracy, and 7 counts of filing false information with regulators. When WorldCom filed for bankruptcy 2.5 years ago, shareholders lost about $180 billion. 20,000 workers lost their jobs. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez hailed Tuesday's verdict as a triumph of the legal system. Ebbers attorney Reen Weingarten accused the government of withholding key evidence.
Again, I think the jury was deprived of important evidence when the government refused to immunize critical executives at WorldCom. The jury should have heard that evidence.
What are the other critical
issues? There were 7 or 8 important pretrial issues. I think it would be tedious and complex to go through all of them. Just check the record and you'll see.
Ebbers' attorney also vowed to appeal the jury's verdict. On Capitol Hill, the Republican-controlled Senate is preparing to vote as early as today to give oil companies the okay to drill for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The 1.5 million acres of land have been under federal protection for 45 years. Environmentalists have described the area as an ecological treasure. The Republican leadership has included the measure in a budget bill, which makes it immune from a Democratic filibuster. And a new Senate investigation has revealed 6 different U.S. banks helped former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet stow away more than $13 million. Riggs Bank, Citibank, and Bank of America were all named in the investigation. Some of the banks allowed Pinochet to use assumed names on accounts. In addition, banks arranged international wire transfers and helped the Pinochet family set up offshore companies. An estimated 3,000 Chileans were killed by Pinochet's regime between 1973 and 1990. In Jerusalem, over 40 world leaders gathered Tuesday to mark the opening of a new Israeli memorial to the Holocaust. The memorial puts on display artifacts, diaries, and photographs of some of the 6 million Jewish victims. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan spoke at the ceremony.
Worldwide revulsion at the genocide, at the systematic murder of 6 million Jews and millions of others, was also a driving force behind the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Our global mission of peace, freedom, and human dignity was literally forged in fire. In fact, the most awful fires mankind has ever seen.
Kofi Annan's wife is the niece of Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg, who saved 100,000 Jews in Hungary during World War II. Wallenberg was arrested by Soviet troops who liberated Budapest and was never heard of again. Meanwhile, Israel today handed over security control of the West Bank city of Jericho to the Palestinian Authority. Soldiers began dismantling some of the checkpoints around the city. For more than 4 years, Israeli troops have controlled all access in and out of Jericho. At last month's summit in Egypt, Israel also agreed to hand over security in 4 other West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Bethlehem. And the family of Rachel Corrie has sued bulldozer manufacturer Caterpillar and the State of Israel in connection with her death. The 23-year-old U.S. activist was killed 2 years ago today in the Gaza town of Rafah. She was run over by a bulldozer operated by an Israeli soldier. We'll speak with her family later in the program. Think about it. Lynn Collins. She died Sunday at the age of 56, known as the female preacher. Lynn Collins is most remembered for her work with James Brown in the 1970s. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is again under fire for ethics violations. Congressman DeLay is one of the most powerful members in Congress and a prolific fundraiser for his party. Last year, the Texas Republican was admonished three times by the House Ethics Committee, once for what they labeled as, quote, inappropriate behavior for trying to influence a House member's vote. In the past few weeks, other allegations have surfaced. These include a Justice Department and Senate committee investigation into whether a group of Republican lobbyists who are close to DeLay provided trips abroad for DeLay, his wife, and other Republican lawmakers to influence legislation. A 2001 trip that DeLay made to South Korea was paid for by an organization registered as a foreign agent. House rules prohibit a foreign principal or lobbyist from paying the travel expenses of House members. Also, the National Journal revealed evidence which showed that Congressmember DeLay illegally accepted money for travel expenses from Jack Abramoff. Abramoff's a GOP lobbyist who is himself under investigation for billing $82 million in lobbying services to Indian tribes. At the same time in Texas, a local grand jury has indicted two of DeLay's political associates on charges involving illegal campaign contributions. The New York Times recently reported DeLay was actively involved in raising money for the political committee, which is the focus of this ongoing investigation. DeLay has continually denied any wrongdoing. Speaking at a weekly session with reporters, he said, quote, "With all the partisan politics of personal destruction, the Democrats have announced and have carried through on. I have yet to be found breaking any House rules. It is very unfortunate that the Democrats have no agenda. All they can do is try to tear down the House and burn it down in order to gain power," he said. To talk further about Tom DeLay, we're joined in Washington by two guests. Shelley Pingree is with us, the president of Common Cause, and Stephen Moore, president of the Freedom Fund Institute. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
I want to start with Shelley Pingree of Common Cause. Can you lay out what the allegations are against Tom DeLay?
Well, actually, I think you've done a very good job of talking about what the current concerns are, both the golfing trip to Scotland and the close ties to the lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who's also being investigated, and the South Korea trip, which perhaps was paid for by a foreign agent, which would have been illegal. And one of the enormous challenges right now is kind of the irony here, is the Republican leadership of the House, including the extremely powerful majority leader, have basically dismantled the ethics process. And years ago, they stopped the opportunity for outside groups such as Common Cause, which routinely filed ethics complaints with the commission. They took away our ability to do that. So the only people who can police them are the ethics committee. And because they've dismantled this committee, the majority leader can't even go in front of them now to find out if there are ethics violations or not. So there's actually no way to currently investigate this except for a Justice Department or outside criminal investigation. So there's sort of an irony here. You have these, you know, very complicated questions being asked about the ties, both to the two things you mentioned and then the continuing investigation of TRIMPAC, which the Ethics Commission earlier, when it was still functioning, decided to set aside, waiting to see if there were indictments in that case. So there is actually nowhere to go to resolve these issues. And yesterday you had the Majority Leader Tom DeLay coming forward and saying, sure, I'd like to have these looked into and prove that they have done nothing wrong. But in fact, they fired the chair of the commission. They took away two members of the ethics committee. They got rid of senior staff, one of whom had been there almost 20 years. And there is no functioning body to investigate this.
Stephen Moore, president of Freedom Fund Institute, respond.
It's the Free Enterprise Fund. Thank you for having me. I've known Tom DeLay for 20 years. I think he's one of the most honorable and honest men I've known in politics, and I've known a lot of politicians over the last two decades. I think that this is an orchestrated smear campaign against Tom DeLay. It's being orchestrated by liberal groups who do not agree at all with Tom DeLay's conservative agenda, groups like Common Cause and many of the liberal media, including the Washington Post and New York Times, have a vendetta, I believe, against Tom DeLay. And I think that what's important for your listeners and viewers to understand is that Tom DeLay is an extremely effective leader of the House. And some people think he's the strongest leader in 50 years in the House. He's also a strong conservative, and he promotes a very strong social and economic conservative agenda. That's one of the reasons that liberals, I think, have their claws out for him. And he's right that he has not been convicted or proven to be in violation of any House rules yet. And yet you've got a lot of people who want to throw him out just based on allegations.
Well, for example, what about the 2001 trip that DeLay took to South Korea, paid for by an organization registered as a foreign agent, which is against House rules?
Right. Well, in that instance, I have talked to DeLay's staff on that particular allegation, and they basically say that there was a third party, a 501c3 organization, which had basically said that it was going to pay for the trip. And so if there was any error here in terms of who paid for the trip, number one, it was inadvertent error, and number two, it was contrary to Tom DeLay's knowledge and what he had been told. So, again, I think if there was a mistake made here, which there may have been, it wasn't Tom DeLay's fault. It was the fault of this third-party organization, which was supposed to be paying for the trip.
And what about the National Journal revelations that showed DeLay illegally accepted money for travel expenses from Jack Abramoff, the Republican lobbyist who is also himself under investigation?
That allegation is simply untrue, that DeLay never received any payments from Jack Abramoff. You know, you've seen all of these allegations that have been made. I mean, my goodness, one of the allegations that was made against DeLay, just so people can realize how foolish some of these are and unfair they are, one was that he illegally profited from a charitable event that he held. Tom's number one interest in terms of philanthropy is foster care, and he had a very large fundraiser in New York at the New York convention and raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for foster care. And then liberal groups come along and say, well, you benefited yourself from this. You got lobbyists to pay for it. I think some of the charges are just really over the top.
Shelley Pingree, can you explain the whole Jack Abramoff controversy and how it ties to Tom DeLay?
Well, again, there is an investigation ongoing of Jack Abramoff, who's accused of basically bilking Indian tribes of millions of dollars and then handing much of that out in political money. Both Mr. Abramoff and Mr. Scanlon are close political allies of Majority Leader DeLay, and Mr. Scanlon was a former press secretary. So these are not sort of distant, you know, see it down the hall relationships. These are people who have been very close over time. And again, there still are allegations that this trip to Scotland, a golf trip, where first there was a visit to a think tank, and then there was a visit to a golf trip. A lot of money was spent, and perhaps Majority Leader DeLay can explain what kind of congressional work was going on the golf trip, but I think that is something he has to explain to people. There are also allegations of a reimbursement of these expenses through Jack Abramoff, and again, these get into some of the technical details of the ethics process, but nobody believes that when you're a member of Congress, an elected official, and as Stephen has said, a very high and powerful elected official, that either you or your staff don't have the responsibility to know both who's paying for the trips and whether they're legitimate. No one in politics is allowed to get away with saying, you know, I didn't know. There is no don't ask, don't tell policy here. This is your responsibility to know. And again, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the Ethics Committee last fall admonished Congressman DeLay for three violations, one of which you mentioned. One was trading influence on the energy bill. One was misuse of the FAA around the whole question about the legislators in Texas who left the state over the redistricting issue. One was the question about a potential bribe on the floor around Medicare. I mean, you know, these are a long-term pattern of abuse of the ethics process, which, again, often is seen in people who have tremendous amount of power in Washington. And the whole reason we have oversight here is so that there can can be, you know, serious questions asked. And in fact, the last time the Ethics Committee was functioning and asked these questions, they said, yes, something has gone wrong here. That was not a Democratic smear. That was a bipartisan Ethics Commission, and in fact, there was retaliation against them. Now we have more allegations coming to light, and nonpartisan groups such as Common Cause and a variety of other groups, Judicial Watch, other organizations coming forward and saying, you know, to have a faith in the elected members of the Congress, you have to have a strong process and be able to investigate these things, which I think bring up real questions, very close ties to this particular Republican administration, but, you know, real issues that have to be raised.
You know, I certainly agree with Shelley that we need to put teeth back into the Ethics Committee, and you're exactly right about that. And as a Republican, I'm troubled by the fact that Republicans, as they have become settled in with power, they're starting to reverse a lot of the congressional reforms that they put in place in 1995 when they swept Democrats out. So that is troubling to me. But some of these allegations, I just think, are extremely unfair. I mean, to say that this was, you know, a golfing trip that he took to Scotland. I mean, there was business done on this trip. He did meet with foreign business leaders and so on. And he also, you know, if you were to say, look, it's a junket if you go play golf, you'd have to evict, you know, two-thirds of the member of Congress, because that's one of the things they do. Now, that may not be right, but it's something that's very commonplace in Congress.
Stephen,
another allegation.
Stephen Moore and Shelley Pingree, we have to break, but we're going to come back to other allegation you want to address. Stephen Moore is president of the Free Enterprise Fund. Shelley Pingree, president of Common Cause. We'll be back with them in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast in over 300 stations around the country, as well as on Free Speech TV and Link TV on Dish Network and DirecTV. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about the controversy that is swirling around Tom DeLay. We are joined by the president of Common Cause, Shelley Pingree, as well as the president of the Freedom Enterprise Fund, Stephen Moore. And we encourage folks to stay with us through this hour as we also talk about Rachel Corrie on the second anniversary of her death. Well, what about what is happening to the Ethics Committee right now? The House facing new controversy around the travel of the majority leader and other lawmakers, left with no mechanism for investigating improper behavior by its members when Democrats shut down the Ethics Committee by refusing to accept Republican rules changes that restrict the panel's power. Stephen Moore.
Well, as I said, I oppose those measures, although I think the Democrats have basically said, unless we get everything we want, we're not going to have an ethics committee, and that's been part of the problem, too. So I think both sides share some blame here. But I wanted to just make this one other point about the unfairness of some of these allegations. One of the points that Shelley and others have been making about Tom DeLay is that he was taking gifts from lobbyists, and then he was voting in favor and promoting the legislation that the lobbyists were in favor of. well, look, this is something that happens every day. It would be like saying Ted Kennedy was guilty of some impropriety because he took money from labor unions and then voted for the labor union agenda. I think just the fact that somebody takes a contribution from a lobbyist and then supports that agenda does not necessarily mean that there was some kind of quid pro quo. I mean, Tom DeLay is a very good fundraiser, and I think that's one of the reasons that Democrats have their claws out for him right now.
Isn't it true that some Republicans are jumping ship quite concerned? I mean, Tom DeLay wanted to change the rules around someone who has a ranking position in the House remaining in office even if they get indicted. And ultimately, the Republicans balked at this.
Well, let me just give you context to that, because I'm not really in favor of that. I do think if someone is indicted, they should give up their leadership position. But this is a special case where what's happening in Texas right now is because of the redistricting that happened in Texas, where Republicans picked up six additional seats because they made the boundaries more competitive and fairer, quite frankly. There was a lot of anxiety and a lot of anger in Texas. And what you've got in Texas is this special prosecutor, who I think is a rogue prosecutor who is out to get DeLay. And there are a lot of people who are worried that he is going to just a grandstand, indict DeLay, and then he would have to stand down as a majority leader and his political career would be ruined. So that's the special circumstance here where people just don't have any trust and any confidence in the competence of this prosecutor in Texas.
Well, we should go back to that because, the
Shelley Pankre.
Yes, sorry. On the TRMPAC investigation, which is, again, the Ethics Commission, when it was functioning, the Ethics Committee decided to set aside any opinion on that until the investigation was completed. And you can argue whether or not that's a partisan question, but the real issue is whether corporate money was taken and put into a state PAC and used for improper purposes. Again, it's a little bit complicated about what it was actually used for, but there are still serious questions being raised. There have been two indictments of close associates of Majority Leader DeLay, and that would be a serious violation of the law in Texas. So there is an actual issue there. And again, even Republicans, as you mentioned, thought that this proposal to say that if you were a member of leadership and you were indicted, you should be automatically allowed to hold your position. Even Republicans backed down at the final hour when that was brought to light.
And but, even if that one allegation were true, though, the Texas one that you're mentioning about TRMPAC, it's important for people to understand Tom DeLay was not even a trustee of that PAC. He was an advisor to the PAC. He did not raise money for the PAC. So even if every allegation was true about TRMPAC violating the law, which I think is questionable, why is Tom DeLay being held accountable for the actions of an organization that he didn't even head?
Well, again, the courts will decide that, and an appropriate ethics process would decide that. I mean, I don't think that organizations like ours are trying to sit here as judge and jury, but we're just saying without an appropriate process, you can't even get to the bottom of those decisions.
I agree with that, but here's the thing. I mean, when you talk about process, how is it fair? I mean, right now, Tom DeLay is under fire from Democrats. There's increasing pressure in the media for him to step down. And how is that a fair process? He has not been, none of these allegations have been proven yet. And he may have to step down simply because people are throwing flaming arrows at him.
You know, in the political process, when you're an elected official, one, you're held to a somewhat higher standard.
Sure.
And it's fine for you to say, they all do this, they take the money, and then they vote in favor of their allies. Well, if there is a pattern of it, and if it's sufficient enough, again, to have a commission like the Ethics Commission where members of your own party say, these things look like inappropriate uses of your position, this isn't just hearsay and allegation. These are actual concrete examples that happen over and over again, and enough to both draw questions in the minds of the public, and I think, as we're seeing, even questions in the minds of the members of his own party, who are starting to say, is this making us look bad when we are the people who need to have the faith of the public
Congress? Yeah, certainly the Republicans want to get this off the front page. It's not good headlines for the Republicans that all of these allegations are being made. I do think because of his conservatism, he is being especially prosecuted here. And also, I think, who's going to want to be in a leadership position in the future? If you get to that position and people try to, character assassinate you and destroy your reputation. And that, I think, is what's happening with Tom DeLay. I do think he is going to survive this. And I think he's going to come out stronger. And I think in a few years he will be the Speaker of the House.
Shelley Pengray, final comment.
Well, you can call it a character assassination, but again, you know, the ethics process has been one of the most important things we've had, and it's worked against Democrats and Republicans. I mean, certainly President Clinton, the use of the Lincoln bedroom, Jim Wright, Speaker of the House from Texas, came under some of the same concerns, and the fact is we depend on this process to be fair. We need to have a functioning ethics commission so that, in fact, you know, if none of these allegations are true and they're not proven in a criminal court, mm-hmm. and the body itself decides that they're not worthy of further concern, then the speaker should or the majority leader should walk away with no tarnish.
The ethics committee is the only committee that is even Democrat and Republican, so it would take one Republican crossing over.
Absolutely. But as you recall, that's what happened earlier. There was a bipartisan decision of the committee, but then Congressman Heffley, who was the chair of the commission, who has still continued to speak out on the importance of having bipartisan ethics rules, he was removed as chair of the committee. So, again, what
removed
it looks
by
like
who?
From the outside. By Speaker Hastert, who works very closely with Majority Leader DeLay. So it looks like that what you've got here is Republican leadership deciding to dismantle the entire process, and it feels like the fox guarding the hen house.
Stephen Moore, do you think it was proper to remove him?
You know, I don't know. I mean, he was the only Republican who was publicly split out of 232 in the House. He was the only one who split with Tom DeLay publicly. So there was a lot of annoyance with him. But I will say this, you know, there is also a lot of anger on the Republican and conservative side of the angle that all the Democrats want to talk about for the last couple of weeks is Tom DeLay. They have no agenda. They have no agenda on Social Security reform. They have no agenda on tax reform. They have no agenda on budget control. They have no agenda on tort reform. And so this kind of obstructionist agenda that is holding up legislation in Congress is being exacerbated.
Though you yourself
all of these allegations.
Though you yourself have said you're becoming increasingly concerned.
Well, I'm only concerned about the fact that that every day the headlines are about Tom DeLay. I think the Washington Post and New York Times really are out to get DeLay. And sometimes when that happens, even if you're innocent, you know, there's an old saying, where do you get your reputation back? Even if you're innocent, in this town, having allegations against you can destroy you.
On that
note,
I want to say thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shelley Pingree, president of Common Cause, and Stephen Moore, president of the Free Enterprise Fund. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Today is the second anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie. On March 16th, 2003, the American peace activist was killed when she attempted to block an Israeli military bulldozer from demolishing the home of a Palestinian pharmacist in Gaza. Eyewitnesses say Rachel was sitting directly in the path of the bulldozer, holding a megaphone and wearing a fluorescent orange jacket when it ran over her, crushing her to death. She was 23. A U.S. congressional resolution demanding an independent inquiry into Rachel's death was buried in committee for months before it expired at the end of the 108th Congress, leaving the Israeli military's investigation, which cleared itself of any wrongdoing, as the only investigation. Now, on the second anniversary of her death, Rachel Corrie's family is suing the State of Israel and the Israeli military. In the lawsuit, which was filed in Haifa Tuesday, the family's asking for roughly $324,000 in direct damages as well as punitive damages. They also said they've yet to receive all the material from the army investigation. This comes as Amnesty International today called on Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to support an independent investigation of Rachel Corrie's death. In a separate lawsuit, the Corrie family is also suing Caterpillar Incorporated, the U.S. firm that manufactures the bulldozer that crushed Rachel. The federal suit alleges Caterpillar violated international and state law by providing specially designed bulldozers to the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, that it knew would be used to demolish homes and endanger people. In response, Caterpillar released a written statement saying, quote, "Caterpillar shares the world's concern over unrest in the Middle East, and we certainly have compassion for all those affected by political strife. However, more than 2 million Caterpillar machines and engines are at work in virtually every region of the world each day. We have neither the legal right nor the means to police individual use of that equipment." In a moment, we'll be joined by Rachel Corrie's father, Craig, and her older sister, Sarah. But first, we wanted to bring you Rachel Corrie speaking just days before her death. She spoke at a mock trial for George W. Bush in Gaza on March 5, 2003, that was held by a group called the Young Palestinian Parliament.
George W. Bush was born on July 6, 1946, in New Haven, Connecticut, to George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara Bush. He grew up in Texas and went on to own a small oil company, Arbusto Energy, which later became part of a larger oil company, Harkin Energy. Both oil companies did business in Colombia and had connections to the Colombian government when it was massacring its civilian population. George Bush went on to work on his father's campaign for president and then to become the governor of the state of Texas. During the time when George W. Bush was governor of the state of Texas, Texas was one of the last states in the United States of America in terms of provision of health care to its people, in terms of environmental quality, in terms of education, and it was also the state with the highest number of inmates sentenced to death on death row, predominantly African American men.
Rachel Corrie, speaking 11 days before her death in Gaza. We're joined in Washington, D.C. by Rachel Corrie's father, Craig Corrie, and her older sister, Sarah Corrie Simpson. In New York, we're joined by Jenny Green, the senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's representing the family in the lawsuit against Caterpillar. Later in the program, we'll hopefully be speaking with Washington Congressmember Adam Smith. I want to begin with Sarah Corrie. Your thoughts on the second anniversary of your sister's death?
First of all, just hearing Rachel's voice, I think, on that tape you just played brings everything back sort of in a rush, so it's hard to comment after that. I think today, as we're walking through Congress here in Washington, D.C., we're trying to not only remember Rachel and remember why Rachel was in Rafah, but also remember the people that she was there for, in particularly the family of Dr. Samir. And for me, that is really the most important information that I hold with me today, is not only Rachel's image, but also the image of Dr. Samir and his three children that were in the home that day that Rachel was trying to protect.
Craig Corrie, can you talk about the lawsuits? I mean, the last 24 hours, you filed two lawsuits against the State of Israel and also against Caterpillar. And this latest news that Condoleezza Rice has called for a full investigation.
Sorry, I couldn't hear the last part of that. But we did file a suit first in Israel. And, of course, we were advised to do that by Chief of Staff to the Secretary of State, who said that the State Department could not help us in trying to find out what happened to Rachel and that we would have to sue in Israel. Of course, we worked for 2 years to have our government take responsibility for finding out what happened, and of course the Israeli government has ultimate responsibility for telling us how they happened to kill Rachel. 2 years did not get any help in that. We found out recently that, of course, the FBI would have to do an investigation in the United States. We found out recently that the FBI doesn't even have a file on Rachel. She doesn't exist in their system. So we had to do something ourselves. Our family has suffered. We've suffered economically as kind of the least of it, but we can be compensated economically for that. So in terms of Israel, we're forced to do that, and we tried to do whatever we could other than that.
I just wanted to correct something I said. Amnesty International is calling on Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, to call for an independent investigation. Have you gotten anywhere with that over this 2 years?
It's essentially no, not yet. We are still working with that. We'll be talking to some people in justice and in the FBI tomorrow, And we would like to pursue that. We think that's the responsibility. When a U.S. citizen is killed, I think one of the first responsibilities of our government is to find out how that happened. And so I'm disappointed that they can't do that.
Well, isn't the Israeli military saying that they didn't see Rachel Corey when the Israeli military bulldozer ran over her and then backed up over her again, crushing her twice?
Well, they have said that, and of course they've also said that they didn't run over her. They've said that she was killed by a wall falling on her. They've said a number of things. That's why we need an independent investigation.
We're going to break, but when we come back, we'll continue to talk about Rachel Corey, the circumstances of her death. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
اخترت لكن ما مشيتوش كم خيال كم خيال جوايا بالحب ابتديت واما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش واما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش واما قربت لعيونك ما لقيتوش
Fifth Son by Kamtari. We're joined in Washington by Sarah Corey Simpson and Craig Corey, the father and sister of Rachel Corey, who died 2 years ago today. Jenny Green in our New York studio is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Jenny, can you explain the Caterpillar lawsuit that has been brought in the last 24 hours against the U.S. company that made the Israeli military bulldozer?
Yeah, the Caterpillar lawsuit charges Caterpillar with its role in the war crimes, the extrajudicial execution of Rachel, her wrongful death, and the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment that she suffered before her death. We've charged Caterpillar because, as other U.S. courts have held, corporations, when they take part in human rights violations and war crimes, they can also be held liable.
We asked a representative of the Israeli government to join us on the show and also Caterpillar, and both declined, though they did make this statement. We have neither the legal right nor the means to police individual use of that equipment, Caterpillar did. What about that? I mean, they can't control who uses the equipment.
Well, the issue is they do control, they do profit from where their Caterpillar tractors are sold. And the argument that we've made, the allegations in the lawsuit, are that the attack on Rachel Corey, as Sarah laid out, this was not a single incident, but a pattern of demolitions of Palestinian homes. Homes were demolished when Palestinians were still in there. And Caterpillar was on notice. They knew from reports from the United Nations, from human rights organizations, from citizens contacting them directly, that their equipment was being used for very dangerous purposes in Gaza, throughout the West Bank. Yet they continued to ship that equipment. They continued to sell it. We have no information that they put any restrictions on it. That they attempted to address the horrific uses to which their equipment was being put. And the fact is that U.S. courts have held that when a company knowingly provides substantial assistance in the commission of human rights violations, they can be held accountable.
Craig Corey, have you spoken with Caterpillar? I know some peace groups have called for a boycott of Caterpillar over the death of Rachel Corey.
We wanted to speak with Caterpillar. We wrote a letter about a year ago to their chairman and asked to speak with him. We even pointed out that we'd be in Peoria to speak with him with a few other people. And no, he declined to speak with us. And in fact, I think I counted 17 riot police out in front of their building to keep my wife and I, and my wife's no more imposing than my daughter, from coming in and speaking to them. So we've asked that they pay attention to this. And they have said, of course, that they can't control what happens to their bulldozers after they sell them. But I certainly agree that they're responsible for continuing to supply the parts, for continuing to sell bulldozers, and they're responsible for knowing how those bulldozers have been used as well as may be used in the future.
We're joined on the telephone now by Washington Congressmember Adam Smith, who took a letter to the office of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon on your behalf. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressman Smith.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Can you talk about this letter that you delivered? What did it say?
Well, I mean, the Corys have, you know, I think, explained very well their concerns, and I share them, that basically the Israeli government did not do a satisfactory investigation, and frankly, we want them to do a satisfactory investigation. And in essence, that's what the letter said. It pointed out some specifics of the inadequacies of the investigation and just requested that they actually do the full and thorough investigation and hold people accountable for their actions. And
what was their response?
Yeah, they're, you know, thank you. I don't want to exaggerate here. It's not likely that they're going to take the letter and, you know, all of a sudden do things differently, but I think it's really important that representatives of the U.S. government make it clear to Israel that we disagree with the way they've handled the situation and continue to try to put pressure on them to handle it better. I also think it's important that our own State Department take steps. Congressman Brian Baird and I, among others, have co-sponsored legislation for us as a nation, as a State Department, to do our own investigation with, you know, cooperation with the Justice Department, which they have not yet done. That, too, would be a step forward. So I think it's all part of the process of making sure that this issue continues to be in the public consciousness and that people understand that it's not done and it's not satisfactorily been completed.
The letter also contained a quote of, then Secretary of State's Chief of Staff,
right,
Wilkerson, saying that investigation needed to be done.
I think actually the quote was a little bit stronger than that found that the investigation was, I forget the exact phrasing, but anyway, inadequate. And basically, we had wanted a full and fair investigation. We don't think we've got one yet. Please move forward.
There is going to be a subcommittee hearing on the State Department's human rights report that you're going to speak at on behalf of the Corys on Thursday. What are you going to say?
I'm going to attend. I never know exactly. We have witnesses and so forth, and I'm, you know, not the chair or ranking member on the committee, so I never know when they're going to get to me. But, you know, I will be there and certainly try to speak. And I will say the same thing to them that I just said to you.
And
we do not have a full and complete investigation. I think we need to continue to put pressure on the Israeli government to do one and also to, you know, do one ourselves.
Brian Avery, another peace activist who had his jaw shot almost off by the Israeli military, has gone to Israel to demand justice. Tom Herndl was shot by an Israeli soldier a month after Rachel died, and he ultimately died. Now, his father was a lawyer from Britain. He went and did an investigation himself because he wasn't satisfied with the investigations that were being done. Many feel it's because of his legal skills that, in fact, a soldier was indicted for the death of his son.
Right.
Craig Corey, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it was largely due to Anthony's legal skills and the time that he spent there. Of course, they had to spend a lot of time in Israel to try and get Tom to the position where he could come back home. I also note that there was a coroner's inquest in Tom's case and also in James Miller's case, and who was another person that was killed about the same time Rachel was, within about two miles of Rachel. And so the London police
James Miller being the cameraman who had gone from Iraq to Gaza to the occupied territories. I'm not sure where he was killed, but killed as he was filming children.
Yes, he was, I think, just about 2 miles to the west of where Rachel was killed, along that same border with Egypt in Rafah. And at any rate, the London police are doing an investigation themselves into the death of those two British citizens. And in fact, have come to our country to talk to an American citizen who was a witness not only to Tom's killing, but also to Rachel's. And it seems to me if England can send policemen here to investigate Tom's killing, that we should surely be able to talk to that same witness in our own country about what happened to Rachel.
What other leverage do you think or pressure can be brought, Congressmember Adam Smith? And what about the very close relationship that the U.S. has with Israel? Certainly has clout. I think Israel, the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid.
Yes, that's true. Now, it's very, very difficult. Certainly we want to continue to make the point, but there are many, many issues going on right now in the Middle East with, the Israeli planned pullout of Gaza, with the, sudden break in the peace process, at least in a more positive way than it was before. There are, many, many issues and many difficulties. But that doesn't mean that they can't deal with this one, and I think we need to continue to make that point.
What are your thoughts on the divestment campaigns that are being waged on college campuses to divest that the U.S. government should not be supporting Israel? World Council of Churches, also the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah, I don't support that. I don't think that we should divest and walk away from Israel. While there are certainly, many things that they have done wrong, they are also in a very, very difficult situation. Their existence is threatened, and in fact not recognized by a good many of their neighbors. And I think we need to continue to try to work in that relationship. Now, obviously, there are aspects of it, and certainly the cases that you've laid out, where, U.S. citizens or British citizens are harmed or killed over there, they need to do an adequate job of investigating it. And I think, what's come out in the Corey case and those other cases you mentioned is they don't. And we certainly need to put pressure on them to change that. But relationships are very, very complex in international policy. I don't think it would be wise or fair or the right policy to say, okay, we're just, not ever going to deal with Israel again. There's too much else going on. We need to try to do both.
By the way, just the latest news on the case of James Miller, the journalist who was killed. The Israeli army has told the family of the British journalist that the soldier responsible will face minor disciplinary charges, despite the investigator's suspicion he illegally shot Miller 2 years ago. His wife said the family intends to bring a civil action for damages against the Israeli army and seek judicial review of the decision not to prosecute the soldier for murder. How much support, Adam Smith, do you have in Congress, in the Senate, for demanding an investigation of the death of Rachel Corrie?
It's hard to say. I forget how many co-sponsors there were on the resolution that Congressman Baird and I introduced. I want to say it was a fairly high number. So there's a fair number of people who are paying attention to this and trying to move it forward. But really, it's Congressman Baird and I who are focused on it. Yes, it is an issue, but unfortunately, for other members of Congress, they have, a lot of other issues as well, and how do we make sure that we keep this, up on the front burner? That's why tomorrow's hearing is so important. That is something where other members of Congress will see. It'll, maybe on C-SPAN, I don't know, it will get some attention, and that's what we're trying to do right now. Is to keep attention on the issue so we can get as many supporters as possible to try to move it forward.
Craig and Sarah Corrie, the father and sister of Rachel, what are you doing in Washington now, and what kind of response have you gotten from Congress and the Senate in calling for an investigation?
First, just to respond to what Congressman Smith was saying, I think there were 78 sponsors on HCR 111, which was the resolution in the House to bring an investigation, an independent investigation into Rachel's killing. We were very grateful for that resolution. We've been told that having 78 members of the House sign on to that bill was very significant. Oftentimes in cases like these, you would not see maybe even 10 or 15 names go on to a bill that would have sort of this political issue raised. So we were very pleased with that. And I think a lot of that also did come from people around the United States calling in to their congresspeople and educating them about this issue. And I think that's really what we're doing here in Washington, D.C. We continue to educate. On the Senate side, our family has met, I believe, with all of the Foreign Relations Committee members. There's possibly one that we have not met with, but we've requested meetings from every office. Many of those offices we've been back to a second time. We've met with many of the members from the Judiciary Committee as well, and as well as some members from the Budget Committee, and that was our focus in coming to Congress. We've had three of my aunts here, as well as my uncle and my father and I. This time around, we were also here back in December. We were here in September. My aunts and uncle were here back in the summer. I think each time we come, we hold approximately 40 meetings in that time. I think we have approximately 16 meetings a day where we're just running from one office to another, speaking with staff people, trying to get FaceTime with members to just let them know about Rachel, let them know about the lack of an investigation in this case, and oftentimes trying to let them know specifically about Dr. Samir and his family and put a face on who those people were in that house that Rachel was trying to defend.
Any last comment, Jenny Green, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who is bringing the suit against Caterpillar?
Yes, I'd like to specifically ask Representative Smith whether there might be anything that Congress could do to increase the regulation on a corporation such as Caterpillar, so that they cannot continue to claim that, well, they don't know where their products are going. Could there be an investigation into their activities? And ultimately, could their activities that we've talked about already be regulated?
Congressmember Smith.
I really don't know. This is actually, moments before I sat down was the first I heard that Caterpillar was going to be involved in this way, that this lawsuit was being filed. So I'd have to look into it before I could give an intelligent answer on that. So, but I certainly will. I have to run, actually. But
well, thank you, Congressmember Smith.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you very much. We'd be happy to work with you further on that.
I want to give Craig and Sarah Curry a final comment at this point on the second anniversary of Rachel's death.
Well, Amy, I'm sitting here looking, and I wish the viewers out there could see a picture of the Nasrallah family and the children. They're standing where their home used to stand and where Rachel was killed. And when I first saw this picture, it was just taken a few days ago, they're remembering Rachel 2 years after she was killed, and yet they've had their home destroyed. But the first thing that came to my mind is how much these children have grown since I've seen them. And, of course, what the world doesn't really remember is those children were behind the wall that Rachel was standing in front of. And had that bulldozer continued on his path, these children wouldn't have grown. And so I hope that I can look at pictures every year of the Nasrallah children and see their smiles and see them continue to grow and become the sort of citizens of the world that we'd all wish they could become.
On that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Sarah and Craig Curry in Washington, D.C., they're lobbying Congress members, and in New York, Jenny Green of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for our program. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can get transcripts and also sign up for our Daily Digest email list and headlines. We are beginning our Unembed the Media tour. If you'd like to help out, you can email us at volunteer@democracynow.org. We'll be going to New York on March 28th, where we are now, and then Houston, Washington, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.